This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Masalek.
And I'm Margaret Flincher.
Well, Margaret, another big name is stepping down. Marilyn Tavener is leaving her post as administrator of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Well, she managed to hold on for that bumpy ride through the initial rollout of the first open enrollment, and she oversaw a dramatic increase in the number of Medicaid recipients across the country. I guess she had some reporting issues, though, that were uncovered in a congressional analysis.
She had to admit that there were overreported the number of Americans who signed up for insurance by around 400,000. It appears patients who signed up for both health coverage and dental coverage separately were actually counted twice.
We know that with so much of the Affordable Care Act, the rollout has been about optics. And while things are going incredibly well this time around, that was an unfortunate lingering black eye.
That was. Tavener has been lauded as a highly capable administrator. She was acting administrator since 2011, was officially confirmed as the head of CMS in 2013. This is one of the most demanding posts in government. The CMS administrator oversees insurance coverage for 1 in 3 Americans with an annual budget of $800 billion.
Well, HHS Secretary Sylvia Matthews-Burwell praised Tavener's tenacity and her professionalism. She lauded her efforts to right the ship after the problem-plagued launch of the insurance marketplace. And she also announced that Andrew Slavitt, the number two person at CMS, will be the acting administrator moving forward. And I think her praise for Marilyn Tavener was well put.
Our guest today has done a deep dive behind the scenes of the creation of the healthcare law. Stephen Brill is a award-winning journalist and author of America's Bitter Pill. He focuses on the need to enact more reforms that actually contain cost in healthcare and stem the exorbitant cost of pharmaceuticals and hospital care, some of the biggest drivers in the $3 trillion a year healthcare industry.
And Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, stops by. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or at CHC Radio on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll get to our interview with Stephen Brill in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Marilyn Tavener is out at CMS. The administrator at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services had weathered the storm of the initial rollout during the problem-plagued launch of the online insurance exchanges, facing the initial issues head-on and still managing to oversee enrollment of some 10 million uninsured Americans first go-round. And while the second open enrollment has been a breeze comparatively, conflicts still lingered. Her office erroneously reported some 400,000 additional sign-ups, only to discover Americans who'd signed up separately for health coverage and dental coverage. She'll be replaced by Andrew Slavitt, the number two person at CMS. And February 15th is the end of the second round of open enrollment. Millions more Americans have already signed up for coverage or re-upped their health plans from last year, with few of the problems experienced the first time around. HHS Secretary Burwell is attempting to head off problems of a political nature. She's reached out to the GOP leadership to seek ways to find common ground in health policy. Burwell feels there will be common ground on finding ways to continue funding for Children's Health Insurance Program, known as CHIP, and finally fixing the sustainable growth rate formula that reimburses physicians for Medicare patient treatment. Meanwhile, the Commonwealth Fund has done a study of the newly insured and their impact on hospital use and costs. Hospitals report a 22% drop in the number of uninsured patients, a significant drop in 1 year. And do you want to just zap the fat off you? FDA has approved a sort of pacemaker to battle obesity. Researchers in St. Paul, Minnesota, found obese patients using the V-block, which blocks the vagal nerve, inhibited hunger messages from stomach to brain. But interestingly, people in the control group lost weight as well. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with attorney and award-winning journalist Stephen Brill, author of several critically acclaimed works, including the recently published America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Mr. Brill's 2013 investigative Time magazine special report, Bitter Pill, which won the National Magazine Award, sought to expose the murky world of healthcare and hospital pricing. Mr. Brill co-founded Journalism Online, a resource assisting online newspaper publishers. He's a professor of advanced journalism at Yale University, where he earned his law degree. Mr. Brill, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare. I think the last time we had you on, we were talking about charge masters, and I think everybody in the country started talking about charge masters.
Yeah.
So you made a lot of hospital administrators quite upset, but I think you illuminated something for the public. And now you've turned your attention to the Affordable Care Act and how it was crafted. I take it you've surmised that the law does indeed extend health coverage as it was intended, but does nothing to cap and contain rising health costs. Could you expound on that for our listeners?
The good news is that it does solve one of the two problems in American healthcare, and that is that alone among the developed countries in the world, we do not provide access to healthcare to tens of millions of our fellow citizens, and this does do that. That's the good news. The bad news is that the way it does it is by having the government subsidize health insurance for those people at the same high prices of care that I talked about in that Time magazine article, the same, you know, charge master prices, the same high prices for prescription drugs. So the lesson of all this, and the reason I wrote the book, was to sort of talk in a more sweeping way about what are the real challenges facing our country, and major challenges that what passes for reform, the only kind of reform that will come out of Washington, is reform that the powers that be in the American healthcare industry will allow to come out. And guess what? What they allow to come out is so-called reform that just makes them richer. We are now paying significant subsidies for people to buy health insurance so they can become the customers of the drug companies who are selling their drugs at the same sky-high prices they were selling at them before, which are, you know, typically 50% more than the price of the exact same drug in Germany, France, Canada, Japan, you name it. And we've done nothing to curb the high profits that so-called non-profit hospitals all across the country enjoy. And when they enjoy those profits, they pay their administrators, their chief executives, their marketing directors, the kinds of salaries that you usually don't even see in private industry.
Well, Stephen, your book, America's Bitter Pill, has been receiving quite a bit of critical acclaim, would be a real understatement.
Well, thank you.
Just, you're everywhere. And Bob Woodward called it a landmark study with brilliant insights. The New York Times says that you've pulled off something extraordinary, crafting a thriller about market structure, government organization, and billing practices.
Yeah, go figure.
And you note that most Americans just don't understand, nor would they have had much opportunity to understand, the complexity of how policy is made in Washington. So maybe distill some of those findings for us.
Well, it starts in the context of, you know, enormous complexity. Healthcare is by far the largest industry in the country. It's 1/6 to 1/5 of the economy. But it's enormously complex. No one can really understand it. And when you have something that no one understands that involves a lot of money, that's where lobbyists do very well. So, for example, there is a provision in the bill allowing for biologic drugs to enjoy a certain period of patent protection. What it means is basically every year of protection they enjoy may add $10 to $15 billion to our healthcare bill that goes into the pockets of those companies. Now, there are good arguments for why they should have patent protection, but that's the kind of arena we're playing in. And almost every paragraph of this 965-page law was heavily lobbied by people whose economic interests are direct. They lose the money. Now, we all have economic interests as taxpayers and as consumers, but our interest isn't as direct. The health industry lobby in Washington spends four times as much as the next largest high-spending industry, and that's the military-industrial complex. So you can imagine the power that they have.
It sounds like this is sort of the regular sausage making that everybody thinks about in that's going on in Washington normally.
Well, it is, except in every case it's something that people can understand. If the formula for how, you know, Medicare reimburses some aspect of kidney dialysis changes, that affects millions of people. It's also about the simple complexity and challenge of governing, of implementing the law, which the Obama administration, sad to say, did a terrible job of, as witnessed by the launch of the website, but also as witnessed by their failure to write regulations that would have helped lots of people, just simply sitting down and writing the regulation. It took them 5 years to write a regulation that limits the kind of bill collecting and lawsuits that the so-called nonprofit hospitals can do for financially needy people who end up in an emergency room, can't pay the exorbitant bill, and get hounded into bankruptcy often. There's a good provision in the law that changes that the hospitals lobbied against. This is one of the rare things that they weren't able to keep out.
You know, your focus has been on many things in the book, but certainly the lack to contain the astronomical cost of healthcare. We've had Governor Deval on the show and Jonathan Gruber and others who said, hey, no, really, the strategy was we thought politically this is what we could get done. And then the next round, which Massachusetts is going through, is that this is the time to do cost control.
Well, they're very candid about it. It's just the question is, how's that next round going? And the answer is it's not going, and it's not going to go. We are the only country in the world that does not control the price of prescription drugs that the government has awarded a patent to. And the irony here is that in the political climate we have, with the Republicans bitterly opposed to Obamacare, even the slightest improvements are not likely to happen. What passes for the notion of an improvement in Obamacare lately is a repeal of the so-called medical device tax, which is a 3% tax on what is probably the highest profit margin industry in the country. That controversy proves that the Democrats are as susceptible to special interests as the Republicans are. You know, among those who support a repeal of that tax are Elizabeth Warren, Al Franken, and Amy Klobuchar. The most prominent medical device maker is a company in Minnesota called Medtronic. Since the day Obamacare was passed, its profits are up 67%, and it's added 5,000 people to its payroll. You know, the reason they put the tax in the first place was, you know, the rationale was the medical device industry is going to get all these new customers because all these new people are suddenly going to have insurance that can pay for all these devices, and that's exactly what has happened.
When we had you on the show the first time, you were shining that spotlight on the irrationality of healthcare pricing. But I think you've been quite open that you found yourself in an emergency situation requiring open heart surgery. Your bill came to a couple of $100,000. What did you learn in examining your own bill and the cost of your own unexpected experience?
This happened, ironically, on the last day of enrollment in the Obamacare exchanges last year, March 31st. My doctor discovered something, and I had a couple of tests, and it turned out that I had something called an aortic aneurysm, and if it bursts, you die. So there I was in the hospital, having, open heart surgery. And first of all, it gave me some perspective. You know, I had written in the first article that we overuse things like MRI tests, but it was an MRI test that saved my life.
Yep.
So the second was, you know, I had considered myself a pretty savvy customer when it came to healthcare. None of that mattered.
Right.
I wasn't a savvy customer. I was a puddle. And you know, when you're in that situation, you are not a consumer. You are not saying, gee, do I really need that extra x-ray? Do I need that blood test? And that's why this isn't a marketplace. And the other thing it taught me was how dysfunctional it is. After I got out of the hospital, I got 36 different explanations of benefits from UnitedHealthcare, my insurance company. And the third envelope I opened said, amount billed, zero. Amount paid for by insurance company, zero. Amount you owe, $154.20. Well, as it turned out, I had scheduled, before I went into the hospital, an interview with the CEO of UnitedHealthcare. And I went out and asked all those questions. And then at the end, I took that explanation of the benefits out of my suit pocket, handed it to the CEO of UnitedHealthcare. Could you explain this to me? And he looked at it. And then he looked up and said, I could sit here all day and I couldn't deal with
that. That's great.
And, you know, here is the single largest consumer product in the United States. And yet the communication that goes to consumers more than any other communication, the explanation of benefits, the CEO of the company, he doesn't even understand what it means. So how are we supposed to understand what it means?
We're speaking today with attorney and award-winning journalist Stephen Brill, author of several critically acclaimed works, including the recently published America's Bitter Pill. You know, Stephen, some economists have said you might have oversimplified the notion that the Affordable Care Act could magically erase decades of unchecked growth in the profit-driven healthcare system. And we had a conversation with Professor Reinhardt talking a little bit about the GDP and the impact on the economy. Would you care if we were paying 20% if we, in fact, had a healthy population?
I mean, I wouldn't tie outcomes to any of this because what we know is that for all the money we spend, our outcomes are not any better. So the notion that if we only spent more, if instead of that, you know, that hepatitis C drug costing, you know, $1,000 a pill, if it only cost $1,200 a pill, our outcomes would be better. I think if our percent of GDP for healthcare is 18%, let's remember that in most other countries, the countries you know we compete with globally, it's 10%, 11%, 9%. So we're taking this big chunk out of the economy to do what all the countries that compete with us do just as well, if not better, for a lot less money. But where the conversation really gets difficult is that there's no way to judge the quality, and God knows you can't judge the quality of any procedure or any hospital or any doctor based on the cost. There are a zillion studies that say that there's no relationship to quality there.
Well, Stephen, we talked about perspective a few moments ago, and our perspective, perhaps from within the world of primary care in particular, is you just got to acknowledge how much changed for the better in the last year or so in terms of so many more people being insured, many on Medicaid, and certainly, you know, an area where we just used to see such suffering, people with pre-existing conditions who, you know, their entire livelihood was going to buy insurance. So that's sort of the positive side. The other side, we couldn't agree with you more, and we are confronted with this reality as are our state Medicaid directors and people who head up corrections facilities. And, you know, the folks who have come up with a very effective treatment for hepatitis C will just have to bear with being the poster child for how can this be, right? How can a pill for something like hepatitis C cost $1,000? And what do we do about it when it clearly is tied to life-saving and life-changing medication? If we gave you the magic wand for Washington, where would you focus your efforts next?
A couple of things. One is that hepatitis C drug is an example. That company would make a lot of money if they sold it for $300 a pill, which is what they sell it for in every other country. And we're the only country that doesn't act to control the price of those drugs, and that's because of the pharmaceutical lobby in Washington. When it comes to hospital care, one of the things I suggest is that we allow hospitals are expanding, they're buying up other hospitals, they're buying up doctors' practices, and exerting, you know, market control. We should encourage them to do as some of these hospital systems are now starting to do, which is sell their own insurance. If the Cleveland Clinic dominates healthcare in much of Ohio, they should be selling insurance, which in fact they just filed to get a license to do so. If I bought my insurance from the Cleveland Clinic, they have a brand name, they have accountability. So if I paid them $8,000 or $10,000 a year to insure me, then they would have no incentive to overtest, to you know keep me in the hospital longer or do anything, you know, because they'd be the insurance company. In effect, they wouldn't want to bill themselves for anything they don't need. Second, they're the kind of brand name that is accountable. Now, if I buy health insurance in Ohio, I have to hope that they're in my network. And my health insurance company is going to be fighting with them all the time over whether this was necessary or that was necessary. Now, having said that, the only way to do that without having all kinds of abuse, regulate heavily what they do because they, in effect, would become a monopoly. And you can regulate them. You can regulate their profit margins. You can regulate the salaries of the executive. And you can have ombudsmen who are available to make sure that you know that once they take your money for the insurance, they're not skimping on your care. But if they were the brand, then they could open up the walk-in centers that are proliferating around the country to take the place of emergency rooms, so the urgent care centers. And I'd much rather go to an urgent care center in Ohio that has the Cleveland Clinic brand and accountability than I would, going to an unregulated urgent care or walk-in center that's been financed by some private equity company.
We've been speaking with attorney, journalist, and writer Stephen Brill, author of America's Bitter Pill. You can learn more about his work at americasbitterpill.com. You can also follow Mr. Brill by going to @StephenBrill on Twitter. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us in Conversations today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It was fun.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Let's take a look at some of the numbers on the Affordable Care Act. The open enrollment period lasts until February 15th, and those who buy their own insurance are renewing or selecting new policies on the state and federal marketplaces. Those marketplaces now have more than 25% more insurance companies than they did in 2014. The average cost for a benchmark silver policy went up by 2%, according to the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation. The benchmark plans are the second lowest cost of the middle-tier silver plans. The cheaper bronze plans went up an average of 4%. But the price changes varied widely geographically. In southeastern Alaska, for example, the benchmark silver plan went up 34%, while the same level plan went down by 45% in Summit County, Colorado. A New York Times analysis showed that it pays to shop around. Last year's second lowest cost silver plan is not necessarily the same as this year's, so many policyholders could see a more substantial premium increase if they stick with their current plans as opposed to switching policies. The ACA's basic tax penalty for not having insurance has doubled for 2015, going from 1% of household income to 2%. And the minimum penalty for those with very low income has more than tripled, going from $95 per adult last year to $325. There's solid evidence that millions have gained insurance coverage under the law, but we won't have firm estimates of how many or how many will remain uninsured for some time. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. In the emergency room or the ICU, clinicians are confronted with a myriad of unpredictable medical crises that sometimes can be challenging to diagnose. Most of these clinicians are now communicating with colleagues via their smartphones, often sending images of a patient's unique symptoms or chest x-rays to one another for shared diagnosis. ICU physician Dr. Josh Landy was noticing a growing trend of image sharing via smartphones to crowdsource second opinions from friends and colleagues across the country. But he also was concerned about the potential violation of HIPAA regulations. So he developed an app for that. He created Figure One, a sort of Instagram for doctors in which images can be de-identified but shared across a dedicated social media platform that would allow input from clinicians within their network. Doctors are using the app to communicate not only with colleagues within their hospital settings, but around the world where someone might have superior expertise with a certain condition. The app was recently used to share a chest image of one of the patients who presented with the Mideastern virus MERS. Dr. Landy says the apps get about 500,000 image views a day, with about 80 million total views so far. He sees the potential for this platform only growing as more young digital natives enter the medical workforce. Figure One is a free download through Apple App Stores and Google Play. A free downloadable app offering secure HIPAA-compliant image sharing among clinicians around the world to reduce the time it takes to zero in on a diagnosis by tapping the collective expert instantly. Now that is a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.